Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. I was pleasantly surprised when I opened up the magazine Pain-Free Living to find a lot of information about research studies, therapies, tips for living with chronic pain, and in general, a lot of patient education. Their editorial advisory board includes top experts in the fields of rheumatology, orthopedics, drug therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and mental health. As a publication independent of any larger organization, I suspect this helps keep the focus on the consumer instead of the organization. In this November 2017 issue, I hope we have time to read about the possibility of a link between pain and the weather, diagnosis and treatment of pelvic pain, some book recommendations, and if I can squeeze it in, some information with recipes about broccoli. We're going to start with Cloudy with a Chance of Pain. This is written by Dr. Nicola Davies. Many people who suffer from some form of chronic pain report that the weather in some way affects the severity of their pain. Physicians admit that patients often complain about muscle, joint, or nerve pain because of changes in temperature or a surge of coldness. According to Dr. Stephen Humble, a consultant at the London Pain Clinic, a significant majority of patients with chronic pain report that their symptoms are aggravated by changes in the weather. Generally, it's cold, damp weather that has the most impact. However, patients can also mention other weather conditions having an impact. Another physician, Dr. Zenu Kirkor, a consultant in anesthesia and pain medicine, who runs the pain clinic at the Princess Royal Hospital in Telford, Shropshire, UK, says, "In my clinic, patients often say that when they travel to Spain or the south of France, or generally moving from a colder to a warmer area of Europe, their pain was better." Some evidence of the pain-weather relationship does exist, although some findings are conflicting and limited only to one type of pain, osteoarthritis. A 2007 study provides evidence of a link between pain severity among people with osteoarthritis and changes in barometric pressure, the weight of the surrounding atmosphere, and ambient temperature, the temperature of the air in the surrounding environment. In a 2012 study, pain levels were found to increase as barometric pressure increased day to day. No relationship between pain and temperature and precipitation, water vapor such as rain or snow, however, was observed. Most of these reports are anecdotal, especially accounts of patients living with chronic pain who say their pain can effectively predict a change in the weather. The explanations as to why there's pain during weather changes are also mostly still hypothetical. As a result, some people are reluctant to talk about their weather-related pain to family members or even practitioners for fear of being ridiculed. According to William Dixon, professor of digital epidemiology at the University of Manchester School of Biological Sciences and scientific lead for the Cloudy Project, problems can occur when people don't believe patients, including a breakdown in relationships. Clarifying that there is a pain-weather link might help patients provide the evidence that their suggested link is indeed true. Launched by the University of Manchester in 2016, Cloudy is a national smartphone-based study that aims to investigate the association between pain and weather. According to Louise Cook, project manager of the study, the scope of this project is to establish whether there is a relationship between weather and pain, and if so, what that relationship is. We will look at the range of chronic pain conditions reported by our participants against weather variables captured by local weather stations. Participants in the study are living with arthritis and/or chronic pain. Funded by Arthritis Research UK, the project provides members of the public with a special application on which they can track their pain symptoms daily. Using the participants' smartphone global positioning system, data about the local weather conditions are automatically captured and corresponded with the symptom data reported by the participant. Approximately 9,000 people in the UK alone have participated in the study during its first 6 months, which has generated over 2.5 million pieces of data. Given the remote nature of data capture in the study design, the project can involve people from a range of temperatures and climates all over the world, and thus is also the world's first smartphone-based study that can explore in detail the weather-pain link. Based on preliminary results, there does seem to be a link between the number of sunny days and levels of precipitation and changes in pain severity. Specifically, the data analyzed in this interim review were captured from participants residing in three UK cities, Leeds, Norwich, and London. Between February and April 2016, the researchers found that as the number of sunny days increased, almost doubling, the length of time during which participants experienced severe pain markedly decreased. However, as participants entered the summer season in June, which had slightly fewer sunny days than April and more rainfall that led to a warmer and wetter climate, participants across the three cities reported increased incidence of severe or very severe pain. Interestingly, London participants reported the highest pain severity during June. Of the three cities, London experienced the warmest temperatures but the fewest number of sunny days in June. With the opportunity to involve participants throughout the four seasonal changes, the CLOUDY study can begin to shed light on what exactly causes pain severity for a range of chronic pain conditions in relationship to changes in the weather. Currently, there are several theories but no proven mechanisms. As Humble states, I'm not aware of any specific scientific research into the pain-weather link explanation, and so feel that the relationship at present is best described as uncertain. It is clear, however, that people suffering from chronic pain have altered bodily interpretations of coldness and hotness. In a proportion of patients with neuropathic pain, nerve pain, the thermal thresholds of the nerves can be altered, i.e., an average person may start to feel heat-related pain or discomfort at 50 degrees Celsius, but for a person with neuropathic pain, the temperature threshold to experience pain or discomfort may be lower. Furthermore, Humble says, people with hypersensitivity to cold due to neuropathic pain are unable to keep their hands submerged in a bucket of iced water for as long as the average person. This is referred to as the cold pressor test. Kirkor adds, as for the nerve pain, often a cold environment makes the neuropathic pain worse. People with trigeminal neuralgia, severe facial pain, experience pain attacks when exposed to cold or blowing wind. And patients with fibromyalgia, a chronic pain condition affecting muscles and soft tissue, generally do not tolerate cold and feel better in a warm environment. Nonetheless, experts do attempt to explain the pain-weather link. Some experts believe changes in atmospheric pressure also create pressure on the joints and push the synovial fluid, the fluid that reduces friction between cartilages, toward the subchondral bone, the bone layer beneath the cartilage in a weight-bearing joint, impacting some nerve endings. Other experts consider pain severity a chemical reaction to the change in weather, whereby the change in atmospheric pressure induces immune cells to produce inflammatory responses, which can cause or exacerbate feelings of physical pain. Some experts believe that the perceived link between pain and the weather is potentially psychological in nature. As Kirker reveals, some of his patients report experiencing less severe pain when moving to sunnier parts of Europe. The relation here may be twofold. A, warm, dry weather is better for arthritic joints, and B, people in nice weather generally feel better and are less depressed, relaxed, and in a better mood, and it makes their pain more bearable, he explains. The initial results from the CLOUDY study suggest that pain severity is associated with changes in sunshine, temperature, and rainfall. Such findings do not yet provide a clear explanation as to what exactly causes or influences pain. However, the study opens the door to several beneficial implications for chronic pain sufferers and the prescription and development of their treatments. While the study is based in the UK, the results could also have global implications for people living with severe pain. How can people better manage their pain, knowing that there is a chance the weather could affect the severity of their pain? According to Kirkor, as I used to say to my patients, I'm unable to offer them a hot sun-on prescription, but they can manage by moving to warmer environments when possible. People with trigeminal neuralgia usually prefer to stay indoors during cold and windy periods. Fibromyalgia patients often like to swim, but they do not tolerate cold water in normal public swimming pools and choose warmer ones commonly used for hydrotherapy. Humble comments, people living with chronic pain could move to a country with a different climate. They could wrap up warmer than usual. In addition, they could ask to have higher doses of their medication to cover them over certain times of the year, and then reduce the dosages during the good times to minimize the chance of becoming tolerant to medications. He adds that some patients respond well to prescription topical menthol cream that helps desensitize joints. Generally, people suffering from chronic pain must keep the change in weather in mind by wearing protective clothing, stretching and loosening the joints, using heating or cooling pads or creams, and staying mobile to keep warm and prevent any swelling. The interim findings of the CLOUDY study are very promising, but the researchers are keen to gather more robust data. As Dixon reveals, we haven't yet performed a formal analysis of this pain-weather relationship. This will only come after the end of the data collection period next year. In the meantime, many researchers and people find living with pain and are eager for the final results. We move on to an article by Abraham Rivera, MD, also from our October-November 2017 Pain-Free Living. This is titled Perplexed by Pain. Kimberly is 32 years old. She was born in a small town in rural Pennsylvania. Her mother was a school teacher, and her father worked as a lineman for the phone company. When she turned 21, she inherited enough to pay for college from her grandmother. In the words of a wise man, she inherited enough to be able to do anything, but not enough to do nothing. In fact, she had to leave medical school after the first year because pain had started interfering with her life. It began at age 13. After having a normal first period at age 12, which remained uneventful for a few cycles, she started experiencing premenstrual cramps. They became disabling after a few months and prompted her first visit to her pediatrician. She was missing 1 to 2 days of school every month on account of her painful periods. The gynecological issue perplexed her pediatrician, who knew a referral to a specialist was in order. With no pediatric gynecologist in her small town, either Kimberly would have to visit a non-pediatric gynecologist or her parents would have to take her 275 miles to Philadelphia, which was not an option. The local gynecologist, a compassionate septuagenarian, also treated her mother and remembered treating her grandmother. A number of tests and ultrasounds later, Kimberly was diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS. She started treatment, but it did not provide much relief. By the time she was 18 and ready to head off to college, she had tried most available treatments, as well as numerous ultrasounds and a number of laparoscopies. All efforts were futile. She had become sexually active, but never had much of a libido. Boyfriends were not very understanding of her frequent mood shifts, and she had difficulty maintaining steady relationships. By the time she was 21, she gave up on expressing her sexuality and dressed as simply as she could. Her ability to procure male companionship was dismal, and she knew it. She gave up on even trying and decided to go to medical school. Throughout most of her adult life, she'd interacted with many doctors and figured she could withstand the training and lifestyle. It did not work. Academically, she had what it took, But the stress of school, poor sleeping patterns, and chronic pelvic pain simply drained her of the stamina to pursue a medical career. She had to admit defeat, something she'd never dealt with before. She started seeing a counselor and a psychiatrist. Kimberly's pain had taken a toll on her life and now demanded at least 4 days out of every month. 4 days at home, locked in her room, cramping, hating her ovaries. She visited a new gynecologist, a young female doctor who suggested she see a pain specialist. Kimberly initially frowned upon the idea, not wanting to become dependent on drugs. A urology specialist found nothing wrong with her kidneys, ureters, or bladder and referred Kimberly to a gastroenterologist. After a range of tests and having a scope explore every gastrointestinal orifice, she received the same disheartening news. "I do not know what is causing the pain, but there's nothing wrong with your stomach, gut, or colon. Not my area of expertise." Out of desperation, she visited a chiropractor who advertised chiropractic treatments for chronic pelvic pain. After 16 visits, she did not feel any better and knew this was another dead end. Kimberly realized that the American healthcare system is not user-friendly. Imagine taking your car to a mechanic for a new engine bay rattle. The mechanic tells you, "I do not work on that brand of car. It could be the muffler." You go to the muffler guy next door who charges you a fee just to look at the car, but is not able to help. He tells you, "There's nothing wrong with your muffler. It could be the transmission. That will be $100. Then the transmission guy can find nothing wrong, so he tells you to see another specialist, and it goes on and on. 6 months later, you learn to live with the engine rattle. Our healthcare system promotes specialization. The more specialized the physician, the more he or she can charge for a given level of service. An organ as small as the eye can have 4 or 5 subspecialists who each treat only one part of the eyeball, and each one charges more for a smaller segment of the organ. A patient who accesses the healthcare system at the wrong level can easily travel a journey of dozens of unnecessary tests, costly procedures, and ultimately poor satisfaction with the care. Whose fault is this? Kimberly knew she had to reorient. She went back to her primary care doctor but requested a new patient appointment, insisting on quality face-to-face time and not leaving the office without 2 things. A diagnosis, even a working diagnosis, and a plan for care. She read on her insurance company's website that it is her right to ask for these. After this appointment, she was referred to a pain management specialist. Her first visit with the pain specialist showed how completely different the approach to diagnosing and managing the problem would be this time. It all went back to the basics: a thorough medical history and detailed physical examination. A sober look at the medical documentation of the tests followed. The conclusion? She never really had PCOS. It was a basket diagnosis assigned to her after everything else was ruled out. It's similar to going to the supermarket and seeing a strange fruit. It is not an apple or a pear, certainly not an orange. Therefore, it must be a lemon. Even in this day and age, sometimes the process of elimination is the only way for doctors to diagnose conditions. Irritable bowel syndrome turned to be a more plausible diagnosis for Kimberly, one missed by the gastroenterologist she'd visited years before. She worked with her pain specialist on a dietary modification regimen that included avoidance of trigger foods and taking up healthy lifestyle habits such as exercise, nutritious eating, and weight control. A diagnosis of pelvic floor dysfunction soon followed. Treatment was initiated by the pain management doctor that she once refused to see. After a number of diagnostic tests, she was prescribed a muscle relaxant, baclofen. It really made a difference. A pelvic floor rehabilitation specialist guided her through pelvic floor strengthening exercises. She also underwent a hypogastric plexus block, which yielded immediate and amazing results. Her pain was gone. For an entire week, she had no pain. Her hope for an answer to her maladies was finally a reality. Her pain returned after about a week, but it was not nearly as bad, and she'd gained something priceless. She now knew for a fact that her pain could be controlled. Kimberly's sleep patterns became more regular and she was able to hold a steady job. Surprisingly, her libido was aroused and she started dating a coworker. Intimacy followed and was not nearly as painful as she remembered. With the help of a sex therapist, she was able to maintain a mutually exclusive, satisfying, monogamous relationship with Joe. Kimberly exemplifies one of the most difficult medical conditions to treat, chronic pelvic pain. Often, patients get lost in the complex architecture of the healthcare system, and the condition remains undertreated or not treated at all. Access to the healthcare system should start at the level of a well-trained family physician or primary care provider. The idea is that he or she will identify the magnitude of the problem and consult with their subspecialized peers about a patient's care. The connection with the PCP should never be lost, and the care should not be surrendered to the specialist, but only subrogated to a specific problem. The healthcare system can seem broad and convoluted, and it is easy to get lost without the guiding light of the PCP. I like the analogy of building a house. When you're building a house, there are plumbers, electricians, and bricklayers, but there is one general contractor overseeing everything to make sure you end up with the house you wanted. Think of your family physician as that person overseeing your healthcare. We're going to go to the column called Bookshelf. This is written by Matt Mendenhall, and they offer three new books about pain and wellness. First is called Healing Arthritis, Your Three-Step Guide to Conquering Arthritis Naturally, written by Susan Bloom, MD, MPH, and published by Scribner in 2017, priced at $28. Functional medicine has been described as a method that addresses the underlying causes of disease using a systems-oriented approach and engaging both patient and practitioner in a therapeutic partnership. The author of this book, Dr. Susan Bloom, is a leader in the functional medicine field. She's the founder of the Bloom Center for Health in Rye Brook, New York, an advisor to the Institute for Functional Medicine, and an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. In this, her second book, she shares her science-based drug-free treatment plan for the almost 50 million people who suffer from arthritis. The book's most intriguing section addresses how healing your gut will heal your joints. Bloom notes that in the last few years, strong evidence has emerged about the connection between arthritis, gut microbial dysbiosis, and increased intestinal permeability, a condition called leaky gut syndrome. She explains the connection in detail and offers a plan and lots of recipes for how to combat leaky gut and reduce joint pain. Why It Hurts, A Physician's Insights on the Purpose of Pain, by Anish Singla, MD, and this is published by Idea Press Publishing in 2017 and priced at $24.95. The goal of this book, according to its author, a Harvard-trained pain specialist, is to help readers develop resilience whether they are coping with chronic pain, caring for someone who is, or simply seeking a deeper understanding of a profoundly important subject. Dr. Anish Singla, the medical director of the Rockville Center of National Spine and Pain Centers in Rockville, Maryland, discusses why we have pain, how aggressively it should be treated, the difference between good and bad pain, and how we become better equipped to use our pain as the powerful adaptive tool that it can be. Pain can be a transformative experience, and the idea of resilience and how pain can and does make us stronger is often ignored. This book offers a lens through which to see pain as more than just an inconvenience. It offers a new vision of why it hurts and what we should do about it. Learn more at www.whyithurtsbook.com. And the third book is called The Record Keeper, Pathway to Greater Well-Being, written by Marie C. Nieder and published in 2017. That is priced at $16. Until 2 years ago, the magazine you're reading was known as Arthritis Self-Management, and one of our sister publications is Diabetes Self-Management. So it shouldn't be surprising that we still subscribe to the concept of self-management, that people with chronic illness or pain should participate in decisions about their care. If you live with pain, one step you can take is to write down information about your health every day. In 2009, Marie Nieder began keeping notes on her health using a composition book, and recently she created this useful journal. It's designed to be used daily, one page per day, to record what you eat and drink, what time you wake up, which exercises you do, your pain level, the day's chief complaint, and more. If you use the book and stick with it every day, the timeline it reflects should be helpful to you and your healthcare provider. And that is available from Amazon or from Nieder's website, www.therecordkeeper.us. And we have time to look at alleviating the fear of exercise, which I think we could all learn something from. At least I know I could. Are you afraid of exercise? A new study published in the journal Arthritis Care and Research has determined that many people with knee osteoarthritis are fearful of embarking on any kind of exercise or physical therapy program, despite ample research showing that physical activity is highly beneficial for arthritis patients. This fear, the researchers say, might be doing these patients more harm than OA itself. Why are they afraid? Researchers from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill categorized 350 patients with symptomatic knee OA by age, sex, race, and education, and rated them according to activities of daily living: depressive symptoms, history of falls and knee injury, family history of knee problems, a balance test, and a measurement known as the Knee Injury and Osteoarthritis Outcome Score. The researchers found that fear of exercise was surprisingly common. They concluded that the patient's fear of exercise mainly derived from the severe pain and psychological stress associated with OA, which can make patients afraid that any kind of movement will only cause further pain. The problem is that without medically approved physical activity, OA patients might only face greater pain, poorer physical function, and both physical and psychological infirmity. Now, that's a terrible place to leave it, but I have to, and I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well and come back next week. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, WXXI.org.